and glaive, the vampire rises from his grave. Translated into English by William Beatty Kingston.
The Death of Halpin Frazer by Ambrose Bierce. Ambrose Gwinnett Bierce, 1842-1914, was born in Meigs County, Ohio, and grew up in Indiana with his mother and eccentric father. He was the 10th of 13 children, all of whose names began with the letter A. When the Civil War broke out, he volunteered and was soon commissioned a first lieutenant in the Union Army, seeing action in the Battle of Shiloh. It seems that every bit of his life and every word he wrote was dark and cynical, earning him the sobriquet Bitter Bierce. He became one of the most important and influential journalists in America, writing columns for William Randolph Hearst's San Francisco Examiner. He is remembered today for his devastating Devil's Dictionary, in which he defined saint as a sinner revised and edited, befriend as to make an ingrate, and birth as the first and direst of all tragedies. His most famous story is An Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge, in which a condemned prisoner believes he has been reprieved just before the rope snaps his neck. It was filmed 3 times and was twice made for television, once by Rod Serling and once by Alfred Hitchcock. In 1913, he accompanied Pancho Villa's army as an observer. He wrote a letter to a friend dated December 26, 1913. He then vanished, one of the most famous disappearances in history. The Death of Halpin Frazer was first published in book form in Can Such Things Be?, New York, Cassell, 1893.
The Death of Halpin Frazer by Ambrose Bierce. Read by Paul Michael. For by death is wrought greater change than hath been shown. Whereas in general the spirit that removed cometh back upon occasion, and is sometimes seen of those in flesh, appearing in the form of the body it bore, yet it hath happened that the veritable body without the spirit hath walked. And it is attested of those encountering who have lived to speak thereon, that a lich so raised up hath no natural affection nor remembrance thereof, but only hate. Also, it is known that some spirits which in life were benign become by death evil altogether. Hall. Part 1. One dark night in midsummer, a man waking from a dreamless sleep in a forest lifted his head from the earth, and staring a few moments into the blackness said, "Catherine LaRue." He said nothing more. No reason was known to him why he should have said so much. The man was Halpin Frazer. He lived in St. Helena, but where he lives now is uncertain, for he is dead. One who practices sleeping in the woods with nothing under him but the dry leaves and the damp earth, and nothing over him but the branches from which the leaves have fallen and the sky from which the earth has fallen, cannot hope for great longevity. And Frazer had already attained the age of 32. There are persons in this world, millions of persons, and far and away the best persons, who regard that as a very advanced age. They are the children. To those who view the voyage of life from the port of departure, the bark that has accomplished any considerable distance appears already in close approach to the farther shore. However, it is not certain that Halpin Frazer came to his death by exposure. He had been all day in the hills west of the Napa Valley, looking for doves and such small game as was in season. Late in the afternoon it had come on to be cloudy, and he had lost his bearings, and although he had only to go always downhill, everywhere the way to safety when one is lost, the absence of trails had so impeded him that he was overtaken by night while still in the forest. Unable in the darkness to penetrate the thickets of manzanita and other undergrowth, utterly bewildered and overcome with fatigue, he had lain down near the root of a large madrono, and fallen into a dreamless sleep. It was hours later, in the very middle of the night, that one of God's mysterious messengers, gliding ahead of the incalculable host of his companions sweeping westward with the dawn line, pronounced the awakening word in the ear of the sleeper, who sat upright and spoke, he knew not why, a name, he knew not whose. Halpin Frazer was not much of a philosopher, nor a scientist. The circumstance that, waking from a deep sleep at night in the midst of the forest, he had spoken aloud a name that he had not in memory, and hardly had in mind, did not arouse an enlightened curiosity to investigate the phenomenon. He thought it odd, and with a little perfunctory shiver, as if in deference to a seasonal presumption that the night was chill, he lay down again and went to sleep. But his sleep was no longer dreamless. He thought he was walking along a dusty road that showed white in the gathering darkness of a summer night. Whence and whither it led, and why he traveled it, he did not know, though all seemed simple and natural, as is the way in dreams. For in the land beyond the bed, surprises cease from troubling, and the judgment is at rest. Soon he came to a parting of the ways. Leading from the highway was a road less traveled, having the appearance, indeed, of having been long abandoned, because, he thought, it led to something evil. Yet he turned into it without hesitation, impelled by some imperious necessity. As he pressed forward, he became conscious that his way was haunted by invisible existences, whom he could not definitely figure to his mind. From among the trees on either side, he caught broken and incoherent whispers in a strange tongue which yet he partly understood. They seemed to him fragmentary utterances of a monstrous conspiracy against his body and soul. It was now long after nightfall, yet the interminable forest through which he journeyed was lit with a wan glimmer, having no point of diffusion, for in its mysterious illumination, nothing cast a shadow. A shallow pool in the gutted depression of an old wheel rut, as from a recent rain, met his eye with a crimson gleam. He stooped and plunged his hand into it. It stained his fingers. It was blood. Blood, he then observed, was about him everywhere. The weeds, growing rankly by the roadside, showed it in blots and splashes on their big, broad leaves. Patches of dry dust between the wheelways were pitted and spattered as with a red rain. Defiling the trunks of the trees were broad maculations of crimson, and blood dripped like dew from their foliage. All this he observed with a terror which seemed not incompatible with the fulfillment of a natural expectation. It seemed to him that it was all in expiation of some crime which, though conscious of his guilt, he could not rightly remember. To the menaces and mysteries of his surroundings, the consciousness was an added horror. Vainly he sought, by tracing life backward in memory, to reproduce the moment of his sin. Scenes and incidents came crowding tumultuously into his mind, one picture effacing another, or commingling with it in confusion and obscurity. But nowhere could he catch a glimpse of what he sought. The failure augmented his terror. He felt as one who has murdered in the dark, not knowing whom or why. So frightful was the situation, the mysterious light burned with so silent and awful a menace, the noxious plants, the trees that by common consent are invested with a melancholy or baleful character, so openly in his sight conspired against his peace. From overhead and all about came so audible and startling whispers and the sighs of creatures so obviously not of earth that he could endure it no longer. And with a great effort to break some malign spell that bound his faculties to silence and inaction, he shouted with the full strength of his lungs. His voice, broken, it seemed, into an infinite multitude of unfamiliar sounds, went babbling and stammering away into the distant reaches of the forest. Died into silence, and all was as before. But he had made a beginning at resistance, and was encouraged. He said, "I will not submit unheard. There may be powers that are not malignant traveling this accursed road. I shall leave them a record and an appeal. I shall relate my wrongs, the persecutions that I endure. I, a helpless mortal, a penitent, an unoffending poet." Halpin Frazer was a poet only as he was a penitent, in his dream. Taking from his clothing a small red leather pocketbook, one half of which was leaved for memoranda, he discovered that he was without a pencil. He broke a twig from a bush, dipped it into a pool of blood, and wrote rapidly. He had hardly touched the paper with the point of his twig when a low, wild peal of laughter broke out at a measureless distance away, and growing ever louder, seemed approaching ever nearer. A soulless, heartless, and unjoyous laugh, like that of the loon, solitary by the lakeside at midnight. A laugh which culminated in an unearthly shout close at hand, then died away by slow gradations, as if the accursed being that uttered it had withdrawn over the verge of the world whence it had come. But the man felt that this was not so, that it was nearby, and had not moved. A strange sensation began slowly to take possession of his body and his mind. He could not have said which, if any, of his senses was affected. He felt it rather as a consciousness, a mysterious mental assurance of some overpowering presence, some supernatural malevolence, different in kind from the invisible existences that swarmed about him, and superior to them in power. He knew that it had uttered that hideous laugh, and now it seemed to be approaching him. From what direction he did not know, dared not conjecture. All his former fears were forgotten, or merged in the gigantic terror that now held him in thrall. Apart from that, he had but one thought: to complete his written appeal to the benign powers who, traversing the haunted wood, might sometime rescue him if he should be denied the blessing of annihilation. He wrote with terrible rapidity, the twig in his fingers rilling blood without renewal. But in the middle of a sentence his hands denied their service to his will. His arms fell to his sides, the book to the earth, and powerless to move or cry out, he found himself staring into the sharply drawn face and blank, dead eyes of his own mother, standing white and silent in the garments of the grave. Part 2. In his youth, Halpin Frazer had lived with his parents in Nashville, Tennessee. The Frazers were well-to-do, having a good position in such society as had survived the wreck wrought by civil war. Their children had the social and educational opportunities of their time and place, and had responded to good associations and instruction with agreeable manners and cultivated minds. Halpin, being the youngest and not over-robust, was perhaps a trifle spoiled. He had the double disadvantage of a mother's assiduity and a father's neglect. Frazer Pear was what no Southern man of means is not, a politician. His country, or rather his section and state, made demands upon his time and attention so exacting that to those of his family he was compelled to turn an ear partly deafened by the thunder of the political captains and the shouting, his own included. Young Halpin was of a dreamy, indolent, and rather romantic turn, somewhat more addicted to literature than law, the profession to which he was bred. Among those of his relations who professed the modern faith of heredity, it was well understood that in him the character of the late Myron Bayne, a maternal great-grandfather, had revisited the glimpses of the moon, by which orb Bayne had in his lifetime been sufficiently affected to be a poet of no small colonial distinction. If not specially observed, it was observable that while a Frazer who was not the proud possessor of a sumptuous copy of the ancestral poetical works, printed at the family expense and long ago withdrawn from an inhospitable market, was a rare Frazer indeed, there was an illogical indisposition to honor the great deceased in the person of his spiritual ancestor. Halpin was pretty generally deprecated as an intellectual black sheep who was likely at any moment to disgrace the flock by bleating in meter. The Tennessee Frazers were a practical folk, not practical in the popular sense of devotion to sordid pursuits, but having a robust contempt for inequalities unfitting a man for the wholesome vocation of politics. In justice to young Halpin, it should be said that while in him were pretty faithfully reproduced most of the mental and moral characteristics ascribed by history and family tradition to the famous colonial bard, his succession to the gift and faculty divine was purely inferential. Not only had he never been known to court the muse, but in truth, he could not have written correctly a line of verse to save himself from the killer of the wise. Still, there was no knowing when the dormant faculty might wake and smite the lyre. In the meantime, the young man was rather a loose fish, anyhow. Between him and his mother was the most perfect sympathy, for secretly the lady was herself a devout disciple of the late and great Myron Bayne, though with the tact so generally and justly admired in her sex, despite the hardy calumniators who insist that it is essentially the same thing as cunning, she had always taken care to conceal her weakness from all eyes but those of him who shared it. Their common guilt in respect of that was an added tie between them. If in Halpin's youth his mother had spoiled him, he had assuredly done his part towards being spoiled. As he grew to such manhood as is attainable by a southerner who does not care which way elections go, the attachment between him and his beautiful mother, whom from early childhood he had called Katie, became yearly stronger and more tender. In these romantic natures was manifest in a signal way that neglected phenomenon, the dominance of the sexual element in all the relations of life, strengthening, softening, and beautifying even those of consanguinity. The two were nearly inseparable, and by strangers observing their manners were not infrequently mistaken for lovers. Entering his mother's boudoir one day, Halpin Frazer kissed her upon the forehead, toyed for a moment with a lock of her dark hair which had escaped from its confining pins, and said, with an obvious effort at calmness, "Would you greatly mind, Katie, if I were called away to California for a few weeks?" It was hardly needful for Katie to answer with her lips a question to which her telltale cheeks had made instant reply. Evidently, she would greatly mind, and the tears, too, sprang into her large brown eyes as corroborative testimony. "Ah, my son," she said, looking up into his face with infinite tenderness, "I should have known that this was coming. Did I not lie awake a half of the night weeping, because during the other half Grandfather Bayne had come to me in a dream, and standing by his portrait, young too, as handsome as that, pointed to yours on the same wall? And when I looked, it seemed that I could not see the features. You had been painted with a face cloth, such as we put upon the dead. Your father has laughed at me, but you and I, dear, know that such things are not for nothing. And I saw below the edge of the cloth the marks of hands on your throat. Forgive me, but we have not been used to keeping such things from each other. Perhaps you have another interpretation. Perhaps it does not mean that you will go to California. Or maybe you will take me with you?" It must be confessed that this ingenious interpretation of the dream in the light of newly discovered evidence did not wholly commend itself to the son's more logical mind. He had, for the moment at least, a conviction that it foreshadowed a more simple and immediate, if less tragic, disaster than a visit to the Pacific coast. It was Halpin Frazer's impression that he was to be garrotted on his native heath.
"Are there not medicinal springs in California?"
Mrs. Frazer resumed before he had time to give her the true reading of the dream.
"Places where one recovers from rheumatism and neuralgia? Look, my fingers feel so stiff, and I am almost sure they have been giving me great pain while I slept."
She held out her hands for his inspection. What diagnosis of her case the young man may have thought it best to conceal with a smile, the historian is unable to state. But for himself, he feels bound to say that fingers looking less stiff and showing fewer evidences of even insensible pain have seldom been submitted for a medical inspection by even the fairest patient desiring a prescription of unfamiliar scenes. The outcome of it was that of these two odd persons having equally odd notions of duty, the one went to California, as the interest of his client required, and the other remained at home in compliance with a wish that her husband was scarcely conscious of entertaining. While in San Francisco, Halpin Frazer was walking one dark night along the waterfront of the city when, with a suddenness that surprised and disconcerted him, he became a sailor. He was, in fact, shanghaied aboard a gallant ship and sailed for a far country. Nor did his misfortunes end with the voyage, for the ship was cast ashore on an island of the South Pacific, and it was 6 years afterward when the survivors were taken off by a venturesome trading schooner and brought back to San Francisco. Though poor in purse, Fraser was no less proud in spirit than he had been in the years that seemed ages and ages ago. He would accept no assistance from strangers, and it was while living with a fellow survivor near the town of St. Helena, awaiting news and remittances from home, that he had gone gunning and dreaming. Part 3. The apparition confronting the dreamer in the haunted wood, the thing so like yet so unlike his mother, was horrible. It stirred no love nor longing in his heart. It came unattended with pleasant memories of a golden past, inspired no sentiment of any kind. All the finer emotions were swallowed up in fear. He tried to turn and run from before it, but his legs were as lead. He was unable to lift his feet from the ground. His arms hung helpless at his sides. Of his eyes only he retained control, and these he dared not remove from the lustreless orbs of the apparition, which he knew was not a soul without a body, but that most dreadful of all existences infesting that haunted wood, a body without a soul. In its blank stare was neither love, nor pity, nor intelligence, nothing to which to address an appeal for mercy. An appeal will not lie, he thought, with an absurd reversion to professional slang, making the situation more horrible, as the fire of a cigar might light up a tomb. For a time, which seemed so long that the world grew gray with age and sin, and the haunted forest, having fulfilled its purpose in this monstrous culmination of its terrors, vanished out of his consciousness with all its sights and sounds, the apparition stood within a pace, regarding him with the mindless malevolence of a wild brute, then thrust its hands forward and sprang upon him with appalling ferocity. The act released his physical energies without unfettering his will. His mind was still spellbound, but his powerful body and agile limbs, endowed with a blind, insensate life of their own, resisted stoutly and well. For an instant he seemed to see this unnatural contest between a dead intelligence and a breathing mechanism only as a spectator. Such fancies are in dreams. Then he regained his identity almost as if by a leap forward into his body, and the straining automaton had a directing will as alert and fierce as that of its hideous antagonist. But what mortal can cope with a creature of his dream? The imagination creating the enemy is already vanquished. The combat's result is the combat's cause. Despite his struggles, despite his strength and activity, which seemed wasted in a void, he felt the cold fingers close upon his throat. Borne backward to the earth, he saw above him the dead and drawn face within a hand's breadth of his own, and then all was black. A sound as of the beating of distant drums, a murmur of swarming voices, a sharp, far cry, signing all to silence. And Halpin Fraser dreamed that he was dead. Part 4. A warm, clear night had been followed by a morning of drenching fog. At about the middle of the afternoon of the preceding day, a little whiff of light vapor, a mere thickening of the atmosphere, the ghost of a cloud, had been observed clinging to the western side of Mount St. Helena, away up along the barren altitudes near the summit. It was so thin, so diaphanous, so like a fancy made visible, that one would have said, "Look quickly, in a moment it will be gone." In a moment it was visibly larger and denser. While with one edge it clung to the mountain, with the other it reached farther and farther out into the air above the lower slopes. At the same time it extended itself to north and south, joining small patches of mist that appeared to come out of the mountainside on exactly the same level, with an intelligent design to be absorbed. And so it grew and grew until the summit was shut out of view from the valley, and over the valley itself was an ever-extending canopy, opaque and gray. At Calistoga, which lies near the head of the valley and the foot of the mountain, there were a starless night and a sunless morning. The fog, sinking into the valley, had reached southward, swallowing up ranch after ranch, until it had blotted out the town of St. Helena 9 miles away. The dust in the road was laid. Trees were adrip with moisture. Birds silent in their coverts. The morning light was wan and ghastly, with neither color nor fire. 2 men left the town of St. Helena at the first glimmer of dawn and walked along the road northward up the valley towards Calistoga. They carried guns on their shoulders, yet no one having knowledge of such matters could have mistaken them for hunters of bird or beast. They were a deputy sheriff from Napa and a detective from San Francisco, Holker and Jarrelson, respectively. Their business was manhunting. "How far is it?" inquired Holker as they strode along, their feet stirring white the dust beneath the damp surface of the road. "The White Church, only a 1/2 mile farther," the other answered. "By the way," he added, "it is neither white nor a church. It is an abandoned schoolhouse, gray with age and neglect. Religious services were once held in it, when it was white, and there is a graveyard that would delight a poet. Can you guess why I sent for you, and told you to come armed?" "Oh, I never have bothered you about things of that kind. I've always found you communicative when the time came. But if I may hazard a guess, you want me to help you arrest one of the corpses in the graveyard." "You remember Branscombe?" said Jarrelson, treating his companion's wit with the inattention that it deserved. "The chap who cut his wife's throat? I ought. I wasted a week's work on him and had my expenses for my trouble. There is a reward of $500, but none of us ever got a sight of him." "You don't mean to say—" "Yes, I do. He has been under the noses of you fellows all the time. He comes by night to the old graveyard at the White Church." "The devil. That's where they buried his wife." "Well, you fellows might have had sense enough to suspect that he would return to her grave sometime. The very last place that anyone would have expected him to return to. But you had exhausted all the other places. Learning your failure at them, I laid for him there." "And you found him?" "Damn it, he found me. The rascal got the drop on me. Regularly held me up and made me travel. It's God's mercy that he didn't go through me. He's a good one, and I fancy the 1/2 of that reward is enough for me, if you're needy." Holker laughed good-humoredly, and explained that his creditors were never more importunate. "I wanted merely to show you the ground and arrange a plan with you," the detective explained. "I thought it as well for us to be armed, even in daylight." "The man must be insane," said the deputy sheriff. "The reward is for his capture and conviction. If he's mad, he won't be convicted." Mr. Holker was so profoundly affected by the possible failure of justice that he involuntarily stopped in the middle of the road, then resumed his walk with abated zeal. "Well, he looks it," assented Jarrelson. "I'm bound to admit that a more unshaven, unshorn, unkempt, and un-everything wretch I never saw outside the ancient and honorable order of tramps. But I've gone in for him, and can't make up my mind to let go. There's glory in it for us, anyhow. Not another soul knows that he is this side of the Mountains of the Moon." "All right," Holker said. "We will go and view the ground." And he added, in the words of a once favorite inscription for tombstones, "Where you must shortly lie. I mean, if old Branscombe ever gets tired of you and your impertinent intrusion. By the way, I heard the other day that Branscombe was not his real name." "What is?" "I can't recall it. I had lost all interest in the wretch, and it did not fix itself in my memory. Something like Pardee. The woman whose throat he had the bad taste to cut was a widow when he met her. She had come to California to look up some relatives. There are persons who will do that sometimes. But you know all that." "Naturally. But not knowing the right name, by what happy inspiration did you find the right grave? The man who told me what the name was said it had been cut on the headboard." I don't know the right grave. Gerelson was apparently a trifle reluctant to admit his ignorance of so important a point of his plan. I have been watching about the place generally. A part of our work this morning will be to identify that grave. Here is the White Church. For a long distance the road had been bordered by fields on both sides, but now on the left there was a forest of oaks, madronos, and giant spruces whose lower parts only could be seen, dim and ghostly in the fog. The undergrowth was, in places, thick, but nowhere impenetrable. For some moments Holker saw nothing of the building, but as they turned into the woods it revealed itself in faint gray outline through the fog, looking huge and far away. A few steps more, and it was within an arm's length, distinct, dark with moisture, and insignificant in size. It had the usual country schoolhouse form, belonged to the packing-box order of architecture, had an underpinning of stones, a moss-grown roof, and blank window spaces, whence both glass and sash had long departed. It was ruined, but not a ruin, a typical Californian substitute for what are known to the guidebookers abroad as monuments of the past. With scarcely a glance at this uninteresting structure, Gerelson moved on into the dripping undergrowth beyond. "I will show you where he held me up," he said. "This is the graveyard." Here and there among the bushes were small enclosures containing graves, sometimes no more than one. They were recognized as graves by the discolored stones or rotting boards at head and foot, leaning at all angles, some prostrate, by the ruined picket fences surrounding them, or infrequently by the mound itself showing its gravel through the fallen leaves. In many instances, nothing marked the spot where lay the vestiges of some poor mortal, who, leaving a large circle of sorrowing friends, had been left by them in turn, except a depression in the earth, more lasting than in the spirits of the mourners. The paths, if any paths had been, were long obliterated. Trees of a considerable size had been permitted to grow up from the graves and thrust aside with root or branch the enclosing fences. Over all was that air of abandonment and decay which seems nowhere so fit and significant as in a village of the forgotten dead. As the two men, Gerelson leading, pushed their way through the growth of young trees, that enterprising man suddenly stopped and brought up his shotgun to the height of his breast, uttered a low note of warning, and stood motionless, his eyes fixed upon something ahead. As well as he could, obstructed by brush, his companion, though seeing nothing, imitated the posture and so stood, prepared for what might ensue. A moment later, Gerelson moved cautiously forward, the other following. Under the branches of an enormous spruce lay the dead body of a man. Standing silent above it, they noted such particulars as first struck the attention, the face, the attitude, the clothing, whatever most promptly and plainly answers the unspoken question of a sympathetic curiosity. The body lay upon its back, the legs wide apart. One arm was thrust upward, the other outward, but the latter was bent acutely, and the hand was near the throat. Both hands were tightly clenched. The whole attitude was that of desperate but ineffectual resistance to... what? Nearby lay a shotgun and a game bag, through the meshes of which was seen the plumage of shot birds. All about were evidences of a furious struggle. Small sprouts of poison oak were bent and denuded of leaf and bark. Dead and rotting leaves had been pushed into heaps and ridges on both sides of the legs by the action of other feet than theirs. Alongside the hips were unmistakable impressions of human knees. The nature of the struggle was made clear by a glance at the dead man's throat and face. While breast and hands were white, those were purple, almost black. The shoulders lay upon a low mound, and the head was turned back at an angle otherwise impossible. The expanded eyes staring blankly backward in a direction opposite to that of the feet. From the froth filling the open mouth, the tongue protruded, black and swollen. The throat showed horrible contusions, not mere finger marks, but bruises and lacerations wrought by two strong hands that must have buried themselves in the yielding flesh, maintaining their terrible grasp until long after death. Breast, throat, face were wet. The clothing was saturated. Drops of water, condensed from the fog, studded the hair and mustache. All this the two men observed without speaking, almost at a glance. Then Holka said, "Poor devil. He had a rough deal." Jarlson was making a vigilant circumspection of the forest, his shotgun held in both hands and at full cock, his finger upon the trigger. "The work of a maniac," he said without withdrawing his eyes from the enclosing wood. "It was done by Branscombe. Pardee." Something half hidden by the disturbed leaves on the earth caught Holker's attention. It was a red leather pocketbook. He picked it up and opened it. It contained leaves of white paper for memoranda, and upon the first leaf was the name Halpin Fraser, written in red on several succeeding leaves, scrawled as if in haste and barely legible, were the following lines, which Holker read aloud, while his companion continued scanning the dim gray confines of their narrow world and hearing matter of apprehension in the drip of water from every burdened branch. "Enthralled by some mysterious spell, I stood in the lit gloom of an enchanted wood. The cypress there and myrtle twined their boughs, significant in baleful brotherhood. The brooding willow whispered to the yew. Beneath the deadly nightshade and the rue, with immortals self-woven into strange funeral shapes and horrid nettles grew. No song of bird nor any drone of bees, nor light leaf lifted by the wholesome breeze. The air was stagnant all, and silence was a living thing that breathed among the trees. Conspiring spirits whispered in the gloom, half heard, the stilly secrets of the tomb. With blood the trees were all adrip, the leaves shone in the witchlight with a ruddy bloom. I cried aloud, the spell, unbroken still, rested upon my spirit and my will. Unsouled, unhearted, hopeless and forlorn, I strove with monstrous presages of ill. At last the viewless—" Holker ceased reading. There was no more to read. The manuscript broke off in the middle of a line. "That sounds like Bane," said Jarlson, who was something of a scholar in his way. He had abated his vigilance and stood looking down at the body. "Who's Bane?" Holker asked, rather incuriously. "Myron Bane, a chap who flourished in the early years of the nation, more than a century ago. Wrote mighty dismal stuff. I have his collected works. That poem is not among them, but it must have been omitted by mistake." "It is cold," said Holker. "Let us leave here. We must have up the coroner from Napa." Jarlson said nothing, but made a movement in compliance. Passing the end of the slight elevation of earth upon which the dead man's head and shoulders lay, his foot struck some hard substance under the rotting forest leaves, and he took the trouble to kick it into view. It was a fallen headboard, and painted on it with the hardly decipherable words, "Catherine LaRue."
"LaRue! LaRue!"
exclaimed Holker with sudden animation. "Why, that is the real name of Branscombe, not Pardee. And bless my soul, how it all comes to me. The murdered woman's name had been Fraser." "There is some rascally mystery here," said Detective Jarlson. "I hate anything of that kind." There came to them, out of the fog, seemingly from a great distance, the sound of a laugh, a low, deliberate, soulless laugh, which had no more of joy than that of a hyena night-prowling in the desert. A laugh that rose by slow gradation, louder and louder, clearer, more distinct and terrible, until it seemed barely outside the narrow circle of their vision. A laugh so unnatural, so unhuman, so devilish that it filled those hardy manhunters with a sense of dread unspeakable. They did not move their weapons nor think of them. The menace of that horrible sound was not of the kind to be met with arms. As it had grown out of silence, so now it died away. From a culminating shout which had seemed almost in their ears, it drew itself away in the distance, until its failing notes, joyless and mechanical to the last, sank to silence at a measureless remove.
Ken's Mystery by Julian Hawthorne. Julian Hawthorne, 1846 to 1934, was born in Boston, the only son of Nathaniel Hawthorne. Because of his father's job as American consul in England, the family traveled extensively throughout Europe, and Julian displayed interest in drawing and philosophy, then studied civil engineering at Harvard. He was bored with this career, however, and against his family's wishes, decided to become a writer. What he lacked in genius, he compensated for with perspicacity, producing a vast number of novels and short stories, many uncollected from their magazine appearances, much of which was in the mystery, horror, and supernatural genres. His first story, Love and Counterlove, or Masquerading, was immediately accepted by Harper's Weekly, which paid the then-generous sum of $50 for it, and he quickly sold more stories to Scribner's and Lippincott's. Working as a journalist, he covered the Indian famine for Cosmopolitan magazine in 1897 and the Spanish-American War for the New York Journal in 1898. Having lost his money in a farming venture in Jamaica, he entered a contest, reputedly writing A Fool of Nature in 18 days under a pseudonym, published under his own name in 1896, and won a $10,000 prize. He was caught in a silver mine stock fraud and served a year in prison. Ken's Mystery was first published in the November 1883 issue of Harper's New Monthly Magazine. It was first published in book form in David Poindexter's Disappearance and Other Tales, New York, Appleton, 1888.
Ken's Mystery by Julian Hawthorne. Read by Paul Michael. One cool October evening, it was the last day of the month and unusually cool for the time of year, I made up my mind to go and spend an hour or two with my friend Kenningale. Kenningale was an artist, as well as a musical amateur and poet, and had a very delightful studio built onto his house, in which he was wont to sit of an evening. The studio had a cavernous fireplace, designed in imitation of the old-fashioned fireplaces of Elizabethan manor houses, and in it, when the temperature outdoors warranted, he would build up a cheerful fire of dry logs. It would suit me particularly well, I thought, to go and have a quiet pipe and chat in front of that fire with my friend. I had not had such a chat for a very long time, not, in fact, since Kenningale, or Ken, as his friends called him, had returned from his visit to Europe the year before. He went abroad, as he affirmed at the time, for purposes of study, whereat we all smiled, for Ken, so far as we knew him, was more likely to do anything else than to study. He was a young fellow of buoyant temperament, lively and social in his habits, of a brilliant and versatile mind, and possessing an income of $12,000 or $15,000 a year, he could sing, play, scribble, and paint very cleverly, and some of his heads and figure pieces were really well done, considering that he never had any regular training in art. But he was not a worker. Personally, he was fine-looking, of good height and figure, active, healthy, and with a remarkably fine brow and clear, full-gazing eye. Nobody was surprised at his going to Europe. Nobody expected him to do anything there except amuse himself, and few anticipated that he would be soon again seen in New York. He was one of the sort that find Europe agrees with them. Off he went, therefore, and in the course of a few months the rumor reached us that he was engaged to a handsome and wealthy New York girl whom he had met in London. This was nearly all we did hear of him until, not very long afterward, he turned up again on Fifth Avenue, to everyone's astonishment. Made no satisfactory answer to those who wanted to know how he happened to tire so soon of the old world. While, as to the reported engagement, he cut short all allusion to that, in so peremptory a manner as to show that it was not a permissible topic of conversation with him. It was surmised that the lady had jilted him, but on the other hand,
She herself returned home not a great while after, and, though she had plenty of opportunities, she has never married to this day. Be the rights of that matter what they may, it was soon remarked that Ken was no longer the careless and merry fellow he used to be. On the contrary, he appeared grave, moody, averse from general society, and habitually taciturn and undemonstrative even in the company of his most intimate friends. Evidently something had happened to him, or he had done something. What? Had he committed a murder, or joined the Nihilists? Or was his unsuccessful love affair at the bottom of it? Some declared that the cloud was only temporary and would soon pass away. Nevertheless, up to the period of which I am writing, it had not passed away, but had rather gathered additional gloom and threatened to become permanent. Meanwhile, I had met him twice or thrice at the club, at the opera, or in the street, but had as yet had no opportunity of regularly renewing my acquaintance with him. We had been on a footing of more than common intimacy in the old days, and I was not disposed to think that he would refuse to renew the former relations now. But what I had heard and myself seen of his changed condition imparted a stimulating tinge of suspense or curiosity to the pleasure with which I looked forward to the prospects of this evening. His house stood at a distance of 2 or 3 miles beyond the general range of habitations in New York at this time, and as I walked briskly along in the clear twilight air, I had leisure to go over in my mind all that I had known of Ken and had divined of his character. After all, had there not always been something in his nature, deep down and held in abeyance by the activity of his animal spirits, but something strange and separate and capable of developing under suitable conditions into what? As I asked myself this question, I arrived at his door. And it was with a feeling of relief that I felt the next moment the cordial grasp of his hand, and his voice bidding me welcome in a tone that indicated unaffected gratification at my presence. He drew me at once into the studio, relieved me of my hat and cane, and then put his hand on my shoulder. "I am glad to see you," he repeated with singular earnestness. "Glad to see you and to feel you. And tonight, of all nights in the year." "Why tonight, especially?" "Oh, never mind. It's just as well, too. You didn't let me know beforehand you were coming. The unreadiness is all, to paraphrase the poet. Now, with you to help me, I can drink a glass of whiskey and water and take a bit draw of the pipe." This would have been a grim night for me if I'd been left to myself. "In such a lap of luxury as this, too," said I, looking round at the glowing fireplace, the low, luxurious chairs, and all the rich and sumptuous fittings of the room. "I should have thought a condemned murderer might make himself comfortable here." "Perhaps. But that's not exactly my category at present. But have you forgotten what night this is? This is November Eve, when, as tradition asserts, the dead arise and walk about, and fairies and goblins and spiritual beings of all kinds have more freedom and power than on any other day of the year. One can see you've never been in Ireland. I wasn't aware till now that you had been there, either." "Yes, I have been in Ireland. Yes." He paused, sighed, and fell into a reverie from which, however, he soon roused himself by an effort and went to a cabinet in a corner of the room for the liquor and tobacco. While he was thus employed, I sauntered about the studio, taking note of the various beauties, grotesquenesses, and curiosities that it contained. Many things were there to repay study and arouse admiration, for Ken was a good collector, having excellent taste as well as means to back it. But upon the whole, nothing interested me more than some studies of a female head, roughly done in oils and, judging from the sequestered positions in which I found them, not intended by the artist for exhibition or criticism. There were 3 or 4 of these studies, all of the same face, but in different poses and costumes. In one, the head was enveloped in a dark hood, overshadowing and partly concealing the features. In another, she seemed to be peering duskily through a latticed casement, lit by a faint moonlight. A third showed her splendidly attired in evening costume, and jewels in her hair and ears, and sparkling on her snowy bosom. The expressions were as various as the poses. Now it was demure penetration, now a subtle inviting glance, now burning passion, and again a look of elfish and elusive mockery. In whatever phase, the countenance possessed a singular and poignant fascination, not of beauty merely, though that was very striking, but of character and quality likewise. "Did you find this model abroad?" I inquired at length. "She has evidently inspired you, and I don't wonder at it." Ken, who had been mixing the punch and had not noticed my movements, now looked up and said, "I didn't mean those to be seen. They don't satisfy me, and I am going to destroy them. But I couldn't rest till I'd made some attempts to reproduce. What was it you asked? Abroad? Yes or no? They were all painted here, within the last 6 weeks. Whether they satisfy you or not, they are by far the best things of yours I have ever seen. Well, let them alone. And tell me what you think of this beverage. To my thinking, it goes to the right spot. It owes its existence to your coming here. I can't drink alone, and those portraits are not company, though, for aught I know, she might have come out of the canvas tonight and sat down in that chair." Then, seeing my inquiring look, he added with a hasty laugh, "It's November Eve, you know, when anything may happen, provided it's strange enough. Well, here's to ourselves." We each swallowed a deep draught of the smoking and aromatic liquor and set down our glasses with approval. The punch was excellent. Ken now opened a box of cigars, and we seated ourselves before the fireplace. "All we need now," I remarked after a short silence, "is a little music. By the by, Ken, have you still got the banjo I gave you before you went abroad?" He paused so long before replying that I supposed he had not heard my question. "I have got it," he said at length. "But it will never make any more music." "Got broken, eh? Can't it be mended? It was a fine instrument." "It's not broken, but it's past mending. You shall see for yourself." He arose as he spoke, and going to another part of the studio, opened a black oak coffer and took out of it a long object wrapped up in a piece of faded yellow silk. He handed it to me, and when I had unwrapped it, there appeared a thing that might once have been a banjo, but had little resemblance to one now. It bore every sign of extreme age. The wood of the handle was honeycombed with the gnawings of worms and dusty with dry rot. The parchment head was green with mold and hung in shriveled tatters. The hoop, which was of solid silver, was so blackened and tarnished that it looked like dilapidated iron. The strings were gone, and most of the tuning screws had dropped out of their decayed sockets. Altogether, it had the appearance of having been made before the flood, and been forgotten in the forecastle of Noah's Ark ever since. "It is a curious relic, certainly," I said. "Where did you come across it? I had no idea that the banjo was invented so long ago as this. It certainly can't be less than 200 years old, and maybe much older than that." Ken smiled gloomily. "You are quite right," he said. "It is at least 200 years old. And yet, it is the very same banjo that you gave me a year ago." "Hardly," I returned, smiling in my turn, "since that was made to my order with a view to presenting it to you." "I know that. But the 200 years have passed since then." "Yes, it is absurd and impossible, I know, but nothing is truer. That banjo, which was made last year, existed in the 16th century and has been rotting ever since. Stay. Give it to me a moment, and I'll convince you. You recollect that your name and mine, with the date, were engraved on the silver hoop?"
"Yes, and there was a private mark of my own there also."
"Very well," said Ken, who had been rubbing a place on the hoop with a corner of the yellow silk wrapper. "Look at that." I took the decrepit instrument from him and examined the spot which he had rubbed. It was incredible, sure enough, but there were the names and the date precisely as I had caused them to be engraved,
And there, moreover, was my own private mark, which I had idly made with an old etching point not more than 18 months before. After convincing myself that there was no mistake, I laid the banjo across my knees and stared at my friend in bewilderment. He sat, smoking with a kind of grim composure, his eyes fixed upon the blazing logs.
"I'm mystified, I confess," said I. "Come, what is the joke? What method have you discovered of producing the decay of centuries on this unfortunate banjo in a few months? And why did you do it? I have heard of an elixir to counteract the effects of time, but your recipe seems to work the other way. To make time rush forward at 200 times his usual rate in one place, while he jogs on at his usual gait elsewhere. Unfold your mystery, magician. Seriously, Ken, how on earth did the thing happen?"
"I know no more about it than you do," was his reply. "Either you and I and all the rest of the living world are insane, or else there has been wrought a miracle as strange as any in tradition. How can I explain it? It is a common saying, a common experience, if you will, that we may, on certain trying or tremendous occasions, live years in one moment. But that's a mental experience, not a physical one, and one that applies, at all events, only to human beings, not to senseless things of wood and metal. You imagine the thing is some trick or jugglery. If it be, I don't know the secret of it. There's no chemical appliance that I ever heard of that will get a piece of solid wood into that condition in a few months or a few years. And it wasn't done in a few years or a few months either. A year ago today, at this very hour, that banjo was as sound as when it left the maker's hands. And 24 hours afterward, I'm telling you the simple truth. It was as you see it now." The gravity and earnestness with which Ken made this astounding statement were evidently not assumed. He believed every word that he uttered. I knew not what to think. Of course, my friend might be insane, though he betrayed none of the ordinary symptoms of mania. But however that might be, there was the banjo, a witness whose silent testimony there was no gainsaying. The more I meditated on the matter, the more inconceivable did it appear. 200 years, 24 hours. These were the terms of the proposed equation. Ken and the banjo both affirmed that the equation had been made. All worldly knowledge and experience affirmed it to be impossible. What was the explanation? What is time? What is life? I felt myself beginning to doubt the reality of all things. And so this was the mystery which my friend had been brooding over since his return from abroad. No wonder it had changed him. More to be wondered at was that it had not changed him more. "Can you tell me the whole story?" I demanded at length. Ken quaffed another draught from his glass of whiskey and water and rubbed his hand through his thick brown beard. "I have never spoken to anyone of it heretofore," he said. "And I had never meant to speak of it. But I'll try and give you some idea of what it was. You know me better than anyone else. You'll understand the thing as far as it can ever be understood, and perhaps I may be relieved of some of the oppression it has caused me. For it is rather a ghastly memory to grapple with alone, I can tell you." Hereupon, without further preface, Ken related the following tale. He was, I may observe in passing, a naturally fine narrator. There were deep lingering tones in his voice, and he could strikingly enhance the comic or pathetic effect of a sentence by dwelling here and there upon some syllable. His features were equally susceptible of humorous and of solemn expressions, and his eyes were in form and hue wonderfully adapted to showing great varieties of emotion. Their mournful aspect was extremely earnest and affecting, and when Ken was giving utterance to some mysterious passage of the tale, they had a doubtful, melancholy, exploring look which appealed irresistibly to the imagination. But the interest of his story was too pressing to allow of noticing these incidental embellishments at the time, though they doubtless had their influence upon me all the same.
"I left New York on an Inman Line steamer, you remember,"
began Ken, and landed at Havre. I went the usual round of sightseeing on the continent and got round to London in July, at the height of the season. I had good introductions and met any number of agreeable and famous people. Among others was a young lady, a countrywoman of my own, you know whom I mean, who interested me very much, and before her family left London she and I were engaged. We parted there for the time, because she had the continental trip still to make, while I wanted to take the opportunity to visit the north of England and Ireland. I landed at Dublin about the 1st of October, and, zigzagging about the country, I found myself in County Cork about 2 weeks later. There is in that region some of the most lovely scenery that human eyes ever rested on, and it seems to be less known to tourists than many places of infinitely less picturesque value. A lonely region, too. During my rambles I met not a single stranger like myself, and few enough natives. It seems incredible that so beautiful a country should be so deserted. After walking a dozen Irish miles, you come across a group of two or three one-roomed cottages, and, like as not, one or more of those will have the roof off and the walls in ruins. The few peasants whom one sees, however, are affable and hospitable, especially when they hear you are from that terrestrial heaven, whither most of their friends and relatives have gone before them. They seem simple and primitive enough at first sight, and yet they are as strange and incomprehensible a race as any in the world. They are as superstitious, as credulous of marvels, fairies, magicians, and omens, as the men whom St. Patrick preached to, and at the same time they are shrewd, skeptical, sensible, and bottomless liars. Upon the whole, I met with no nation on my travels whose company I enjoyed so much, or who inspired me with so much kindliness, curiosity, and repugnance. At length I got to a place on the seacoast, which I will not further specify than to say that it is not many miles from Ballymakeen, on the south shore. I have seen Venice and Naples. I have driven along the Cornice Road. I have spent a month at our own Mount Desert. And I say that all of them together are not so beautiful as this glowing, deep-hued, soft-gleaming, silvery-lighted ancient harbor and town, with the tall hills crowding round it and the black cliffs and headlands planting their iron feet in the blue, transparent sea. It is a very old place, and has had a history which it has outlived ages since. It may once have had 2,000 or 3,000 inhabitants. It has scarce 500 or 600 today. Half the houses are in ruins or have disappeared. Many of the remainder are standing empty. All the people are poor, most of them abjectly so. They saunter about with bare feet and uncovered heads, the women in quaint black or dark blue cloaks, the men in such anomalous attire as only an Irishman knows how to get together, the children, half-naked. The only comfortable-looking people are the monks and the priests and the soldiers in the fort, for there is a fort there, constructed on the huge ruins of one which may have done duty in the reign of Edward the Black Prince, or earlier, in whose mossy embrasures are mounted a couple of cannon which occasionally sent a practice shot or two at the cliff on the other side of the harbor. The garrison consists of a dozen men and three or four officers and non-commissioned officers. I suppose they are relieved occasionally, but those I saw seemed to have become component parts of their surroundings. I put up at a wonderful little old inn, the only one in the place, and took my meals in a dining saloon 15 feet by 9, with a portrait of George I, a print varnished to preserve it, hanging over the mantelpiece. On the second evening after dining, a young gentleman came in, the dining saloon being public property, of course, and ordered some bread and cheese and a bottle of Dublin stout. We presently fell into talk. He turned out to be an officer from the fort, Lieutenant O'Connor, and a fine young specimen of the Irish soldier he was. After telling me all he knew about the town, the surrounding country, his friends, and himself, he intimated a readiness to sympathize with whatever tale I might choose to pour into his ear, and I had pleasure in trying to rival his own outspokenness. We became excellent friends. We had up a half pint of Kinahan's whiskey, and the lieutenant expressed himself in terms of high praise of my countrymen, my country, and my own particular cigars. When it became time for him to depart, I accompanied him, for there was a splendid moon abroad, and bade him farewell at the fort entrance, having promised to come over the next day and make the acquaintance of the other fellows. "And mind your eye, now, going back, my dear boy," he called out, as I turned my face homeward. "Faith, 'tis a spooky place, that graveyard, and you'll as likely meet the black woman there as anywhere else." The graveyard was a forlorn and barren spot on the hillside, just the hither side of the fort, 30 or 40 rough headstones, few of which retained any semblance of the perpendicular, while many were so shattered and decayed as to seem nothing more than irregular natural projections from the ground. Who the black woman might be, I knew not, and did not stay to inquire. I had never been subject to ghostly apprehensions, and, as a matter of fact, though the path I had to follow was in places very bad going, not to mention a haphazard scramble over a ruined bridge that covered a deep-lying brook, I reached my inn without any adventure whatever. The next day I kept my appointment at the fort and found no reason to regret it, and my friendly sentiments were abundantly reciprocated, thanks more especially, perhaps, to the success of my banjo, which I carried with me, and which was as novel as it was popular with those who listened to it. The chief personages in the social circle besides my friend the lieutenant were Major Malloy, who was in command, a racy and juicy old campaigner with a face like a sunset, and the surgeon, Dr. Dudeen, a long, dry, humorous genius, with a wealth of anecdotical and traditional lore at his command that I have never seen surpassed. We had a jolly time of it, and it was the precursor of many more like it. The remains of October slipped away rapidly, and I was obliged to remember that I was a traveler in Europe, and not a resident in Ireland. The major, the surgeon, and the lieutenant all protested cordially against my proposed departure, but as there was no help for it, they arranged a farewell dinner to take place in the fort on All Hallowe'en. I wish you could have been at that dinner with me. It was the essence of Irish good fellowship. Dr. Dudeen was in great force. The major was better than the best of Lever's novels. The lieutenant was overflowing with hearty good humor, merry chaff, and sentimental rhapsodies anent this or the other pretty girl of the neighborhood. For my part, I made the banjo ring as it had never rung before, and the others joined in the chorus with a mellow strength of lungs such as you don't often hear outside of Ireland. Among the stories that Dr. Dudeen regaled us with was one about the Kern of Kerin and his wife, Ethelind Fionnuala, which being interpreted signifies the white-shouldered. The lady, it appears, was originally betrothed to one O'Connor, here the lieutenant smacked his lips, but was stolen away on the wedding night by a party of vampires who, it would seem, were at that period a prominent feature among the troubles of Ireland. But as they were bearing her along, she being unconscious, to that supper where she was not to eat but to be eaten, the young Cairn of Cairn, who happened to be out duck-shooting, met the party and emptied his gun at it. The vampires fled, and the Cairn carried the fair lady, still in a state of insensibility, to his house. "And by the same token, Mr. Kenningale," observed the doctor, knocking the ashes out of his pipe, "you're after passing that very house on your way here. The one with the dark archway underneath it and the big mullioned window at the corner, you recollect, hanging over the street, as I might say. Go along with the house, Dr. Dudeen, dear," interrupted the lieutenant. "Sure, can't you see, we're all dying to know what happened to sweet Miss Fionnuala, God be good to her, when I was after getting her safe upstairs."
"Faith, then, I can tell you that myself, Mr. O'Connor," exclaimed the major, imparting a rotary motion to the remnants of whiskey in his tumbler. "'Tis a question to be solved on general principles. As Colonel O'Halloran said that time he was asked what he'd do if he'd been the Duke of Wellington and the Prussians hadn't come up in the nick of time at Waterloo. Faith, says the Colonel, I'll tell you. Arrah then, Major, why would you be interrupting the doctor and Mr. Kenningale there, letting his glass stay empty till he hears, the Lord save us, the bottle's empty?"
In the excitement consequent upon this discovery, The thread of the doctor's story was lost, and before it could be recovered, the evening had advanced so far that I felt obliged to withdraw. It took some time to make my proposition heard and comprehended, and a still longer time to put it in execution, so that it was fully midnight before I found myself standing in the cool, pure air outside the fort, with the farewells of my boon companions ringing in my ears. Considering that it had been rather a wet evening indoors, I was in a remarkably good state of preservation, and I therefore ascribed it rather to the roughness of the road than to the smoothness of the liquor when, after advancing a few rods, I stumbled and fell. As I picked myself up, I fancied I had heard a laugh, and supposed that the lieutenant who had accompanied me to the gate was making merry over my mishap. But on looking round, I saw that the gate was closed and no one was visible. The laugh, moreover, had seemed to be close at hand, and to be even pitched in a key that was rather feminine than masculine. Of course, I must have been deceived. Nobody was near me. My imagination had played me a trick, or else there was more truth than poetry in the tradition that Halloween is the carnival time of disembodied spirits. It did not occur to me at the time that a stumble is held by the superstitious Irish to be an evil omen, and had I remembered it, it would only have been to laugh at it. At all events, I was physically none the worse for my fall, and I resumed my way immediately. But the path was singularly difficult to find, or rather the path I was following did not seem to be the right one. I did not recognize it. I could have sworn, except I knew the contrary, that I had never seen it before. The moon had risen, though her light was as yet obscured by clouds, but neither my immediate surroundings nor the general aspect of the region appeared familiar. Dark, silent hillsides mounted up on either hand, and the road, for the most part, plunged downward as if to conduct me into the bowels of the earth. The place was alive with strange echoes, so that at times I seemed to be walking through the midst of muttering voices and mysterious whispers, and a wild, faint sound of laughter seemed ever and anon to reverberate among the passes of the hills. Currents of colder air sighing up through narrow defiles and dark crevices touched my face as with airy fingers. A certain feeling of anxiety and insecurity began to take possession of me, though there was no definable cause for it, unless that I might be belated in getting home. With the perverse instinct of those who are lost, I hastened my steps, but was impelled now and then to glance back over my shoulder, with a sensation of being pursued. But no living creature was in sight. The moon, however, had now risen higher, and the clouds that were drifting slowly across the sky flung into the naked valley dusky shadows, which occasionally assumed shapes that looked like the vague semblance of gigantic human forms. How long I had been hurrying onward I know not, when, with a kind of suddenness, I found myself approaching a graveyard. It was situated on the spur of a hill, and there was no fence around it, nor anything to protect it from the incursions of passers-by. There was something in the general appearance of this spot that made me half fancy I had seen it before, and I should have taken it to be the same that I had often noticed on my way to the fort, but that the latter was only a few hundred yards distant therefrom, whereas I must have traversed several miles at least. As I drew near, moreover, I observed that the headstones did not appear so ancient and decayed as those of the other. But what chiefly attracted my attention was the figure that was leaning or half-sitting upon one of the largest of the upright slabs near the road. It was a female figure draped in black, and a closer inspection, for I was soon within a few yards of her, showed that she wore the kala, or long-hooded cloak, the most common as well as the most ancient garment of Irish women, and doubtless of Spanish origin. I was a trifle startled by this apparition, so unexpected as it was, and so strange did it seem that any human creature should be at that hour of the night in so desolate and sinister a place. Involuntarily I paused as I came opposite her, and gazed at her intently. But the moonlight fell behind her, and the deep hood of her cloak so completely shadowed her face that I was unable to discern anything but the sparkle of a pair of eyes,
which appeared to be returning my gaze with much vivacity. "You seem to be at home here," I said at length. "Can you tell me where I am?" Hereupon the mysterious personage broke into a light laugh, which, though in itself musical and agreeable, was of a timbre and intonation that caused my heart to beat rather faster than my late pedestrian exertions warranted. For it was the identical laugh, or so my imagination persuaded me, that had echoed in my ears as I arose from my tumble an hour or two ago. For the rest, it was the laugh of a young woman, and presumably of a pretty one. And yet it had a wild, airy, mocking quality that seemed hardly